It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn about the potential harm to endangered species through crop acreage devoted to corn. That's a popular feedstock for producing ethanol, which is a renewable fuel. Colin with questions and comments about biofuel and biofuel crops, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Lark is a lead scientist at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at UW-Madison. His new policy analysis is in the journal Biological Conservation. Tyler, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Well, lay it out for us. How is the mass production of ethanol affecting sensitive habitats?
Well, the connection is sort of just as you'd imagine. When we increase demand for ethanol and a product that uses a lot of corn, our landscapes, our farmers respond. We meet that need. We plant more corn, but oftentimes that comes at the cost of habitat. And so it's not really surprising that there's an interaction here. And what we want to do is just be cognizant of that and see if there's ways that where we can mitigate that potential harm.
And is the corn crop the primary issue here, or are there other biofuel crops contributing to the problem?
Yeah, right now, the way this policy is set up, it's the federal renewable fuel standard. Corn ethanol is really the number one biofuel that we produce. And so pretty much everything is coming from corn. And there's calls and interest in shifting away towards more advanced renewable biofuels. But right now it's predominantly corn.
And how much corn does it take to make ethanol? How much of that crop is really contributing to the ethanol industry, if you will?
Well, it's a big piece of agriculture, and our corn crop right now covers anywhere from 80 to 90 million acres of land across the country, and somewhere in the range of 25 to 40% of that gets used for fuel ethanol each year.
Turning to wildlife and species, which endangered species are particularly vulnerable to ethanol production?
Well, there's a whole bunch, a few that we looked at for this study. It really runs the gamut, things from small insects and pollinators up to larger birds and mammals as well as something we often don't think about as aquatic species, things that rely on clean and clear water that might be impacted by nutrient pollution, for example.
Oh, like in the Gulf of Mexico, for instance.
Yeah, right. So we know a lot of our fertilizer that we apply to our farmlands and that we need to produce this food. Unfortunately, we lose a lot of it to the environment as well, and it runs downstream and eventually ends up, if not deposited somewhere else, in the Gulf of Mexico.
So as these lands turn over to corn, it means that wildlife have less and less habitat to be able to live. Is that the primary concern here?
Yeah, so anytime we're expanding production of a single crop, so say corn in this example, there's kind of two ways to do that. We can either switch other crops to corn. So that would be, growing less wheat in Wisconsin, growing less alfalfa, a really valuable crop for our dairy herd, and planting more corn. And in that case, corn is just often a really intensive crop. It requires a lot of fertilizer, and the production and application of that fertilizer results in a lot of greenhouse gas or carbon pollution. And on the other side, you can get more corn by bringing more land into production, and oftentimes that comes at the cost of things like perennial grass pasture that may have been used for grazing or other types of conservation grasslands.
Which is where you bring in, for instance, butterflies and whooping cranes. What are you finding when that lack of habitat isn't there? What connection can you make that it is having an impact?
Yeah, all sorts of potential pathways here. So it's not hard to imagine a bird species or an insect, say a pollinator, something like the rusty patch bumblebee, something found right here in Wisconsin, that needs some of these floral resources. So the nectar, the pollen, to survive as a food source. And those usually come in locations of grasslands or, open fields where there's a diverse mixture of plant species growing and flowering plants that they need. And when you replace that with, say, a monoculture crop, and particularly one that doesn't have a lot of diverse plant life within its boundaries often, that just reduces those resources that a lot of these species rely on.
We're looking at the impact of ethanol production and particularly the impact on wildlife. UW-Madison scientist Tyler Lark, our guide. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. So turning to the renewable fuel standard, Congress establishes it in 2005, expands it in 2007, and this mandate that all transportation fuel must include a minimum volume of renewable fuel. What environmental concerns is this standard meant to address?
Well, initially, I think it came at a time, you know, about 15 years ago when there was a lot of concerns about energy independence, right? So a heavy reliance on petroleum and oil products from the Middle East and elsewhere. And it's still a case, right? We need to move away from petroleum-based and fossil fuels as soon as possible. And you know, nothing about corn ethanol says that we should continue with fossil fuels. But we want to be thoughtful about how we shift away and do that in the best way possible. And so that's where these renewable fuels come in and where this policy came in both in advancing energy independence. But I think the goal was also to try to get some environmental benefits. And we've just seen over the course of the 15 years that it's played out, a lot of the land use changes that can come with the additional need to produce all this extra corn for one single crop and one single fuel had a lot of environmental side effects. And so if there are ways to mitigate those, I think that's the direction that we really want to move going forwards.
A farm is a business, and it, to me, is conceivable that the farmer grows the highest value crop in response to market prices. They have to make choices that make economic sense as well. How is the renewable fuel standard affecting those decisions, perhaps with implications on wildlife conservation and other environmental pressures?
I think it's playing a big role. And you bring up a great point that it's definitely not, you know, it's not the consumers at the pump who are choosing one blend of fuel over the others. And it's definitely not our farmers who are managing and stewarding our lands and the landscape. Often it's the policies, right? And so the policy in this case, this renewable fuel or federal ethanol mandate, is driving these decisions. And so we've seen through our research that it increases the price of crops, especially corn, but other crops as well. And that then drives these changes that we can observe on the landscape.
Putting two agencies together here, the Environmental Protection Agency implements the renewable fuel standard. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service entrusted to protect animals listed as endangered. Do these agencies collaborate on regulating biofuel production?
Right now, I think not to the extent that they could. So there's been, my understanding, some initial discussions. And really what this research says is, hey, there's a lot of potential for interaction here and a lot of opportunity. So if we pull these experts in, folks from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service who study and know and understand these imperiled wildlife and wildlife at large, can we modify this fuel policy that's implemented by the EPA and do so in a way that we can meet, you know, our energy production goals while doing it without jeopardizing or compromising the environment?
We have scientist Tyler Lark studies land use at UW-Madison Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment as we take a closer look at ethanol production and corn crops. Call in with your questions, your comments about corn-based ethanol, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we examine corn ethanol production, biofuels policy, and potential harmful impacts to wildlife conservation. A new journal article finds limited research in this area offers some solutions we'll get into. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Lark is lead scientist at the Global Land Use and Environment Laboratory of UW-Madison. Let's bring in Bill in Barnes. Bill, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. So we're putting corn in our gas tanks because it's better than oil. But when you consider all the energy inputs to produce that ethanol, of fuel to run the tractors, to apply the herbicides, to manufacture the herbicides, to dry the grain, to distill it into alcohol, when the total system of energy inputs is considered, what's the net gain of us essentially putting corn in our gas tank?
Bill, thanks for that question, Tyler.
That's a really good question, and a question people have been looking at now for quite some time, especially that we've upped our investment in ethanol. And all those things, as you mentioned, contribute to this overall climate pollution profile or greenhouse gas emission profile of the fuel. And at the end of the day, when you include all those, it comes out a lot closer than we think. So there's a lot of variance depending on where you grow it and how you grow it. Some studies say corn ethanol is 20% better. Others say it's 20% worse as far as greenhouse gas emissions relative to gasoline. And so, you know, it's sort of a wash there. And that's where I think we have to think about if we're going to have a lot of this fuel, we want to do it in a way that's not also degrading our environment in other dimensions.
Let's look at reducing harm, focusing on potential solutions. What practices would help reduce harm to nearby wildlife?
Yeah, so the great thing is we have a whole set of tools available right now that can help address this. And so conservation agricultural practices, if we're thinking about water quality and we want to have, you know, clean, clear water for habitat for wildlife and for us as humans, as a species as well, practices like putting cover crops on our fields or using conservation tillage practices, things that will reduce the amount of runoff and erosion and contributions to water impairment is a great, easy first step and something that a lot of farmers are already familiar with and know how to do. And so just tying some of those conservation practices to these mandates and other incentives and policies that are in place could go a long ways in reducing some of the environmental impacts.
What about like timing the harvest so it might occur outside a sensitive wildlife nesting season?
Yep, that could be another one, especially as we look towards some of these more advanced biofuels that might be, you can imagine something if we could create a fuel from a native and a perennial grassland and harvest that grass rather than having to plant intensive rows of corn and fertilize it really intensively. There's a lot of potential and excitement there, and you could also manage it in a way that provided great nesting and breeding habitat for these threatened and endangered species, while also providing a really productive product for society and for farmers as well.
And so that might be like a second and third generation fuel, whereas corn and soybeans would be a first generation biofuel?
Yep, exactly.
Okay, let's take another call now. Charlie with us in Beaver Dam. Charlie, what's on your mind?
I'm just saying about land use there on Highway 175 and 49. They're taking over 400 acres and putting it into solar panels. Highway B, just outside of Beaver Dam, they're taking hundreds and another hundreds of acres and putting it into solar panels. It's perfectly good farmland, and then they're taking it and putting solar panels. I was told the one on B is a 50-year lease. So that means that land's going to be out of production for a minimum of 50 years.
Charlie, thank you for that observation. And the role of solar farms here, what impact that can have to not only crop rotations but to wildlife, Tyler?
Charlie brings up a great point. And so our farmers right now and our land managers are feeling pressures from all sorts of dimensions, right? We have continued urban sprawl and development. We have alternative and renewable energy sources like solar photovoltaic systems that we want to get up. And so they're feeling the crunch from all sides. And so just like with renewable fuels and corn ethanol, we want to be thoughtful, I think, in how we site things like solar panels. And so there's emerging concepts, this idea of agrivoltaics. Can we integrate those solar panels on our landscape in a way that they're not going on our prime farmland, but maybe they're, you know, working on the marginal lands that are a little bit less productive and perhaps even integrated with agricultural production? So you can envision maybe grazing sheep underneath the solar panels or intermixing them with crops in a way that was co-beneficial for temperature regulation or water conservation. And so I think actually that solar panel and the expansion of solar production is a huge opportunity, but we, just like with renewable fuels, we want to do it thoughtfully and with some reflection and doing it in a way that can support farmers and our agricultural industry rather than really squeeze them out, which, you know, can be the case in sometimes.
I hear hints of what of being intentional about what we do to these lands and real dual purpose in ensuring a crop can do multiple things and have multiple benefits. Is that where you really would like to push the research?
I think you just put it in words better than I could myself. Yeah, dual purpose, right? Agriculture, we get a lot from it. It's really valuable for production, for society, and for food production in particular for us. But we can also ask more of it and get conservation benefits out of it, or renewable energy production out of it, whether it be through solar or other types of biofuels.
Suburban sprawl, also such an issue, you know, transforming large plots of undeveloped land and putting a crunch on wildlife habitats. How much attention should also be paid by city planners to the conservation of wildlife areas as these developments go in?
Well, we have, yeah, really one single land base, right? They always, the old adage is they're not making any more of it. We're not getting any more land. And so I think it's from all directions. It's at the urban fringe is a really important place to be thoughtful and think about, do we want to have these large sprawling subdivisions or large lot types of housing developments where you have to mow 5 acres of lawn? Or do we want to do it a little bit more densely and efficiently, which also then opens up opportunities for, you know, improved transit and mass transit and reduces the needs for fuels. So it all almost ties together in that sense of having, you know, smart growth in the urban areas and the urban fringe with smart land use in our rural landscapes of how we use our farmland for food and energy production.
Learning about food and energy production and the impact of ethanol production in the mix with UW-Madison scientist Tyler Lark. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Returning now to the renewable fuel standard, a bit more policy here. Last year, we saw the Center for Biological Diversity suing the EPA over its implementation of the renewable fuel standard. And the conservation group says the federal agency has failed to assess how endangered species are impacted. How could, you know, be a solution coming out of the legal back and forth and the litigation?
Yeah, well, I think that probably plays a pretty important role. It's what it does is that I think it helps us dedicate resources to this. So it says, there's something going on here. This is an issue that we care about as society. These two policies, the Renewable Fuel Standard and the Endangered Species Act, are both two huge policies that have huge impacts on our landscapes and our livelihoods. And so getting those experts together in a room, the ones who know each of those policies intricately and say, how can these work together in a mutually beneficial way, I think only good can come of that. And so that's really what our research here that we're talking about today did. And that's what I think some of these legal questions and challenges that have come up are also trying to work towards.
There is this bipartisan group of Midwest governors and fuel industry leaders who are pushing the government to approve higher ethanol sales this summer. What do you make of that idea? And what is the impact of that on the environment?
Well, the research out there kind of suggests that really if that or any policy increases demand, specifically if we were, say, for U.S. corn ethanol, then it's likely that we're going to respond and bring additional land into corn production. And so we know that that then comes along with some of those additional carbon emissions and conversion of wildlife. And so if it increases demand for ethanol, that's the likely outcome. If it just sort of maintains it because there's a declining share of fuel use elsewhere, then the impacts probably aren't as severe.
I need to pick your brain about this. What happens to all this ethanol with EVs that are set to take over the road in the coming years, in the coming decades?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's going to be a slow ramp up probably. And there's always going to be some hard to electrify sectors. If we think of air travel or shipping overseas, or even heavy duty trucking in some cases. So there's probably a role for liquid transportation fuels for a while going forwards. And I think the question is, what proportion of that liquid fuel supply do we want coming from ethanol? And perhaps it will ramp up as gasoline ramps down and sort of replace it. I think an ideal situation would be it ramps up with better biofuels, ones that are more friendly on our landscapes, you know, based off of perennial and native plants. And it continues to probably be a part of that mixture. But as you say, as electric vehicles and more renewable fuels come online, or more renewable ways to produce that electricity come online, it'll continue to be a complement. And we just want to sort of balance that in the best way possible.
It's a balance. Tyler, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Tyler Lark, lead scientist at the Center for Sustainability in the Global Environment at UW-Madison. We have a link to his policy analysis at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Floods, heat waves, blizzard conditions in mid-April, these are all sources of big risk for farmers. An expanding statewide network of weather stations aims to help farmers make better decisions to protect their crops in the changing climate. Bring your questions about environmental monitoring and what is possible to predict. Join in by calling 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Kucharik is an agronomy professor and chair of this department at UW-Madison. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Always great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, so you're leading this plan to establish a mesonet, or a statewide network of weather stations that talk with each other. What do you hope to create that will change in Wisconsin? What are you offering here?
Yeah, well, maybe it's probably helpful just to define for folks out there what a mesonet actually means.
Yes, please do.
So we're talking about a network of automated weather and environmental monitoring stations. In our case, we're, besides measuring things like precip, temperature, wind speed, solar radiation, humidity, we're also going to do soil moisture and temperature. And kind of the thing that sets a mesonet apart is the spatial scale at which the stations are separated by. We're talking about typically tens of miles. And then also the temporal frequency at which that data is being collected and then reported back to the public. So typically it would be anywhere, you know, minutes to maybe 15 minutes. And we're going to be collecting data at about a 5-minute temporal scale. So, you know, we have a lot of other long-term weather observation networks. People, you know, see this on their phones and tablets and computers every day, but oftentimes that data is too sparse across the landscape and is being reported, you know, too infrequently for decision-making, particularly for our agricultural producers. So we're really looking at, you know, creating a much denser, network of observations that people can basically access any time of the day from anywhere freely also.
In terms of minutes or hours, how often are the measurements and observations updated?
Yeah, we hope for about five-minute frequency on the updates. And that depends a little bit on how quickly that data is able to get up to the cloud, as you say, and also then, you know, how the website is interacting with that data. But, you know, somewhere in that, you know, 5 to 10 minute range is the goal.
Back to the mesonet. I mean, I learned that it's derived from the words mesoscale and network. Can you explain what observing and tracking mesoscale weather events means?
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, mesoscale meteorological phenomenon. What does that actually mean? So it's, again, that scale at which these phenomena are actually happening. You're talking about, you know, an extreme rainfall event, a high wind gust. Oftentimes, you know, these are happening at a very localized scale, maybe in someone's backyard, an individual farm field or something like that. And while mesonets obviously aren't so dense that everybody has a, you know, weather station in their backyard, they at least start to increase the density of observations that we have in real time to help us observe and oftentimes better predict down the road how some of these events will play out. Mesonets have been around since, you know, probably the 1940s, you know, as an idea in trying to help understand and predict that mesoscale meteorological phenomenon that often ends up in the news and creating headlines.
When you mentioned sending it up to the cloud, it made me wonder, how do you handle outages, or if a weather station goes offline, how do you do quality control?
Yeah, well, the great thing is that technology, like everything, has advanced in weather data collection. And so these stations, as they're positioned out in the landscape, are basically talking with us, and they're telling us, you know, whether or not things are working well, whether a sensor is maybe out of calibration, the battery's gone dead, things like that. And so as we're building, you know, a team of experts to help stand this up over the next few years, we'll know when something's going wrong out on the landscape, and then can get somebody out there to check in and fix the problem.
With this, like, micro level weather data and soil data, and I want to get more into the soil because I think that's really interesting as well, but setting that aside for a moment, what do you hope farmers can do with this refined data?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, helping to support them through, you know, helping them make better decision making on a daily basis. You know, weather variability, you know, as you were pointing out to start, will continue to pose greater, more significant challenges to management of our crops and soils. And this has a lot to do with pest and disease management, how we time the application of fertilizers, how often and when we irrigate crops, like in our Central Sands region for potato and other vegetables. So it's creating, you know, an observational data network that will eventually feed into the development of decision support tools that will help them make better decisions as the crop season progresses and get them better prepared, because they are making those decisions daily and sometimes just within the day themselves. And coupling that information with a weather forecast will definitely help them, you know, do a better job and help maintain productivity and also help the environment too.
When you talk about irrigation and fertilizer, there is a clear connection there to the role of soil moisture and soil temperature in this data. Can you speak to that?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. This is one sort of new facet to mesonets across the U.S. in terms of how states are collecting data. They're getting that information, you know, looking at, you know, how moist or dry the soil is, how that might be a prelude to drought conditions, you know, whether or not irrigation is actually needed. It's a way to help guide just better decision making to conserve, you know, water in some cases. And, you know, if you think about application of fertilizers or manure on the landscape, there's certain times of the year that soils are not very conducive, whether we don't want people, you know, to be to doing those applications given the conditions. And one other thing that, you know, we've been missing out on is by not having a good grasp of soil moisture statewide, we're kind of at a disadvantage for drought monitoring, which is going to become more important moving forward. I know people might say, oh, it's been really wet for my memory the last 10 or 15 years, and that's definitely the case, but, you know,
not too scientific.
Yeah. But the droughts do happen, and they'll start to happen more frequently and be more intense, you know, during our growing seasons. And by having that data, it helps us and our farmers receive drought relief funding from the federal government. And we just haven't had, you know, a lot of information to this point to help direct, you know, the experts and say, yeah, these are the states that are definitely suffering, and here's the data to back it up. So I think, you know, we're going to be monitoring soil and temperature down to about 3 feet or a meter. So, you know, all the way in the root zone, you know, where the crops are extracting their water, down to a deeper depth in the soils.
Talking about an expanding network of weather stations, Chris Kucharik, professor and chair of the UW-Madison Department of Agronomy, you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Kevin in Janesville. Good morning, Kevin. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, good morning. Thanks for helping the farmers help us. In the spirit of helping us, is this something the National Weather Service can tap into in extreme weather events to help them better predict storm tracks in severe weather for advanced public safety measures?
Kevin, thank you. Chris.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. That's exactly right. So in terms of weather warning issuance and forecasting and assisting in, you know, emergency planning and preparedness, that's exactly the type of thing that we hope will help. And in fact, I'm pulling the National Weather Service and the five forecast offices that have oversight within our state into the conversation. Actually, we're going to be giving them a presentation in a couple, I think, next week. So, but we know from previous experiences in other states that the Weather Service definitely relies on these networks. So great question.
And just a little bit further on that question, what can we learn from Mesonet setups in other states, for instance, like Texas or Oklahoma, other states that have well-established station networks?
Yeah, great question. We're learning a lot about what not to do and what's difficult to maintain these networks. Everyone's sharing their stories. You know, the couple of the gold standards are Oklahoma's Mesonet, which started in, I believe, 1993, as sort of a response to being in Tornado Alley and sort of the extreme weather events and then helping to protect lives and property. And then in New York, out of the outcome of Hurricane Sandy in 2012, there was a influx of federal funds from FEMA to help establish their network. And, you know, in talking to those other, you know, directors, we're just learning about, you know, what makes a good network, how to maintain it, and how to keep the funding solid so you can have this living on in the long term, because that's really the goal.
So Wisconsin currently has a network of 14 weather and soil monitoring stations, and this planned expansion would take it to 90. Is that about right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, the rough goal is, you know, approximately having one station in each county, and then maybe some areas where we'd have a higher density in some of our key ag growing regions for specialty crops like cranberry, potato, vegetables, and then the cherry and apple industry already has a pretty dense network in the Door County area where there's 8 stations in that area right now.
So you feel like 90 would be rather adequate to cover Wisconsin in a really complete way?
Yeah, it's comparable to other states and the density of stations. There is sort of a trade-off between, you know, being larger means you need more resources, you know, to keep that going. And, you know, that could be difficult. And so there's sort of this sweet spot where you want to have a high enough density that's going to be helpful in helping guide, you know, decision-making and protecting, you know, people's lives, property, crops, forestry resources, but not so big and not so small. So, you know, we're going to stand this thing up over the next few years and see how things go and try to make some decisions as we get to nearing our goal.
UW-Madison agronomy professor Chris Kucharik leads this new Wisconsin Environmental Mesonet project. Call in with your questions and comments about weather station networks. What you wonder, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new statewide network of weather stations aims to help farmers as they make decisions about crops. Call in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Kucharik is here, chairs the UW-Madison Agronomy Department, leads a major project to expand Wisconsin's Mesonet network. Chris, you know, we're familiar with the level of weather data available on our smartphone and other devices. Will this expanding network change those weather reports in any way that we receive on our phones and on our devices?
Well, we hope so. That would be a goal. It's not going to be an immediate thing. I mean, a lot of those other observations have different apps and programs that are bringing that information together. But our goal, you know, first we're building out a website, the WiscoNet website, where people can point to and download the data, see maps of certain conditions, you know, and we're working on that. But the bottom line is that at some point we've got to push this information out and develop some apps that make it easier for people to use the data, and especially farmers, when it comes to those decision-making things they have to do on a daily basis. So, yeah, but we've got to work at that. I mean, admittedly, and that'll be a goal and a challenge that we work on over the next few years. So it is easy for people to see and access. And I think by doing that, people will become more familiar with what these types of networks can bring to their daily lives. And I think they'll get used to that and they will want that to continue. So there's my plug.
There would also be a level of automation here, perhaps, of systems talking to one another on the farm and perhaps elsewhere.
Yeah, that's right. There's some of that already. I think, you know, some of our agricultural producers subscribe to services through companies to help some of their decision making. You know, we'd be aiming to bring new data to that pipeline of information that they can use and access. But yeah, it, you know, I'd like to see it where those apps are taking in, you know, our observations and then also incorporating let's say a 3-day forecast from the National Weather Service, which, you know, have been developed at a point scale. And so they can look at, you know, historically, well, what's happened? You know, what's my soil moisture been doing over the last week? What is it currently? And what does the 3 to 7 day forecast say from the Weather Service? And, you know, those forecasts have become very, very accurate, you know, in a short time period. I know some people will say, oh, come on, what are you talking about? But I mean, the way
Is that more powerful computing? What has happened? What has changed?
Yeah, more better modeling, advances in computing, more power, more observations, and just learning about, you know, certain conditions and what happens when those combine and manifest into weather that actually happens out on the landscape. So, you know, that science has advanced enormously. I mean, the advent of satellite meteorology, which birthplace was here at UW-Madison, those are all feeding into this. And I think it's an exciting time. You know, I'm excited about this network. It's long overdue. Wisconsin's been one of, you know, the few states in the U.S. that hasn't had a dedicated MesoNet. So, you know, we're putting ourselves on the map and good things to come.
Let's talk about sustainable funding into the future. The weather station is expanding with funding from the federal government. The Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation kicked in a $2.3 million grant from the Wisconsin Rural Partnership. Will this funding be enough to sustain the network for years to come?
So, yeah, well, first, I mean, I want to thank WARF, the Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation. They kicked in $1 million. That's great, you know, for the infrastructure. The USDA grant, the Institute for Rural Partnerships, which came out of a lot of efforts through our UW external relations team in DC and Senator Tammy Baldwin and our Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education, Steve Ackerman, all played a significant role in that. And the design of this funding was really to help stand up MesoNet, help expand the Wisconsin State Climatology Office through the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research, which has not received funding for decades, and we really need that. You know, the overall goal, you know, through these efforts is to demonstrate to people how important it is to have these observations and this network and a state climatology office. This is the Wisconsin idea at the maximum, you know, in terms of inaction. So it is shorter term, you know, funding. The Institute for Rural Partnerships grant is 4 years, but we feel by demonstrating how important and crucial these data are that funding will be easier to come by. But it's not going to be easy. It'll be a challenge, and we'll have to advocate But by showing and demonstrating to people how these data are useful, I think we'll come out pretty well on the end of this.
In conversation with UW-Madison agronomy professor Chris Kucharik, as we look at this expanding network of weather stations and what it means to Wisconsin, you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Chris, let's say you've decided where you want to put a weather station in this expansion. Can, like, a business or an organization that wants a station perhaps on their property or in their vicinity, can they sponsor a Mesonet station?
These conversations have come up. Yeah, when you think about long-term funding and support, and There is a science to the locations, I mean, a process in trying to figure out how to best represent the gaps in the observations right now and where they are on the landscape. Are they representative of a diverse array of geography and land cover across the state? And then you have to consider the station spacing, you know, that gets to the Mesonet and sort of the definition of what that means. And at the same time, you know, how are we going to work with the public or private lands and that? So there's a lot to be determined. I will say, yeah, that is a possibility. But when you think about how many square miles the state of Wisconsin covers and that we're only putting 90 dots on the landscape, there's probably going to be some people that might be disappointed. And that's probably going to happen. But, you know, through working with the National Weather Service, the Department of Natural Resources, our Department of Ag, our tribal nations, and then K-12 education, we hope to, figure out just what is the best arrangement and then move forward from there. I've been happy to hear, I've gotten some emails from our K-12 teachers who actually have their own weather stations at their middle or elementary schools, and support for that is also something to consider in the siting. I've heard some great stories and some where funding's been cut and they're not able to continue those observations. And, you know, that sort of breaks my heart to know that there's students out there that were being exposed to that science and now are not. So that's my long-winded answer.
Potential collaborators everywhere.
Yes.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity, so thank you so much for having me.
Chris Kucharik is a professor and chair of the UW-Madison Department of Agronomy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.